Yeah, all right. I think we're live here. It is about 4:30 in the afternoon, Belgrade time here in Belgrade, August 16, 2022. Yeah, we're gonna be getting into a development on the Russian strategy for the Balkans and how we pretty much know, if not from about five other things, how we can pretty much know that Odessa is going to wind up a Russian city of some kind. And it's like, you know, it doesn't change the character of Odessa, which as a Russian city historically is this sort of international city of the Eastern Balkans. I mean, you have the different Carpathian, Rusin, you have huge, you know, Romanian / Moldovan, and those are distinct, but there's a big idea that this is the same people too. And it's really Odessa, and people who know Odessa, one of the jewels of the Black Sea.
Papa.
Yes, baby. Let's see here. What? Dai ovo, mama. Dai ovo. Izvini. Ciao. And how this is one of the Black Sea. And it's strategically important, not just for the Black Sea, okay, but the control of this place extends to strategic control over the Danube River itself. Oh, are you back? Okay, great. Come on. Now, you can take this and draw with it. Some of the vidim. Sorry. So you have this, one of the ways that we know that Russia has to take Odessa, and there's a number of ways, but the opportunity cost calculations that we've done sort of informally, and we don't really have all the numbers or all the factors, you know, we could list factors, but then to take those variables and really give them proper, you know, values is hard to do, but you can get an idea of what an equation might look like. And you can see that the cost of going in, the timing of this moment, the charm offensive and the diplomatic preparations required and the economic preparations, all of the total costs of everything going in to this military operation or invasion, if you will, are such that the additional cost of going into Odessa can't really be measured in terms of the cost to do it, but really the cost of not doing it. And then it becomes a very stark conclusion. And it's not only the footing and the position vis-a-vis former Ukraine or with regard to the Black Sea, but we're actually talking about the mouth of the Danube and the geopolitical and, you know, practical political orientation of Romania and Bulgaria. Okay, so in other words, in the first part of this, what we'll say to be clear is that if you're doing politics in Romania and Bulgaria, or if you're looking at industries in the East Balkans that you want to invest or that you think are going to be where the action is at, this is going to line up with the pro-Russian party. So just as it was the case, you know, another generation ago, that you had these sort of minority pro-Western parties that basically ballooned or were launched or catapulted into you know, uber significance practically overnight through the Sorosian structures, right, in Romania and Bulgaria, leading towards this kind of EU hysteria. And, you know, some could argue or have articulated that this was what with the case of like Romania, like in the aftermath of Ceausescu and all this stuff. But yeah, I know it's an ongoing, people call me Floodescu, I know, but it's anyway. So you have that. But Papa. Yes, yeah. Mm. That's me. That means that I'm talking.
Ovo,
da, vidi. Zelina.
Ovo.
Mm-hmm. And so, in once you have this position in the Black Sea, and once you have just, you know, once you have, are you the little I'll show you. But once you have this in place, in this, for the same, by the same rationale that Russia has to mobilize and build on that success, they're going to have to do the same with the Danube. And this is going to solve, additionally, another strategic question. Presently, even though you have these minority parties, you know, in terms of parliament, oftentimes they'll meet or break, you know, pass census, and they'll get funding, and they'll run, and they'll be sitting in parliament and everything good like that. But, you know, they're not, they might even be part of government in some, at some times, like coalition government, but they're definitely pro-Russian. And okay. Oh, okay. Hold on 1 second. 1 second. You know, I fail to deliver on bears and birthday music today, but I didn't fail, you know, on the actual birthday 3 days ago, but I'm failing today. We're trying to keep the party going, you know. She has no idea that her grandfather just passed away. We were at the funeral earlier today. I just picked her up from daycare. Anyway, so with the Danube, you see, this solves a strategic problem, and that strategic problem has been called the internationalization of the Danube. And this has been a project led by the European Union, okay? And the EU believes that they control the Danube, and this is a huge... from a strategic perspective, you're going to be talking not just military, but... from the perspective of energy, because you have hydroelectric and further hydroelectric potential, you know, in terms of the strategy for the waterways, the usage of the waterways, integrating water travel with connectivity, like reasonable connectivity to rail, road, and air, so that traveling on the Danube isn't just tourism. It might be like an option versus like a slower train. But yes, of course, scenic, but now for the large barges and trade, it's actually a critical waterway. And just understand the Danube, it's like the Mississippi, yo. It's like super wide, and it's super deep and super wide. And I mean, there are definitely large parts of the Danube that, looking across, you would think it was a lake, you know. And large parts of the Danube look like a lake looking across, but it's a river, and it's very deep, so it looks still, but in fact, it has a lot of the, you know, the current is very strong. So it carries these boats. It's super important. And Europe's losing it. They're going to lose this. And they never were able to really develop. And I think that when you look at the, you know, I use this expression, pro-Russian parties, as if some abstract fucking, you know, nonsense love for Russia was somehow driving, you know, and that's just not the case. They're called pro-Russian parties in countries like Bulgaria and Romania. But they're actually sovereign, and they're sovereign and developmental oriented. So when you're looking at what is the political platform for investors or whoever you may be, adventurers, soldiers of fortune, conflicts on the horizon, and you're looking at Bulgaria and Romania, this is a place where getting in on the ground floor and looking at the industries that are compatible or kind of ready, turnkey, to plug into what the Russians are doing right now. One of the big crises in Bulgaria and Romania is how their industries have basically gone fallow, and their total capacity, industrial capacity output, and especially food production, has been totally done in this irrational way. One thing to understand about the European Union is that they're opposed to all of their artificial economic development projects for the European states, and they have different kind of zones and stuff. You have like peripheral Europe, and they always get the shit treatment. People talk about the pigs countries like Portugal, Italy, Spain, Greece, Ireland, and you can add to that, you know, later on the like the Balkans and eastern part of Central Europe. I mean, some people call Germany Central Europe, so I mean, you know, Eastern Central Europe, Czech Republic, Slovakia, like all these microstates. Americans be like, well, how is this even a country? And you have a point. But there you have it. So with the sovereign development plan of these parties, they're tapped into the things that were actually the industries that could have, that when, you know, Romania and Bulgaria post-communism, people were like, and very correctly, like, wow, these are industries that are ready to pop off, and it's going to be X, Y, and Z, and these are going to be the revenues, and then we're going to be able to invest in this, that, and the other. And instead, these things were kind of like privatized, and then this strange policy, almost like the policy on Germany post-World War I, is almost like, or the one that was proposed for after World War II, basically just deindustrialize the Balkans. And so built into the strategic thinking long-term for the EU is they don't want any country to develop economically in the rational way that the sort of path of least resistance of capital flows, and based upon the real existing developments of the peculiarities of their own economies and resources, and you know, the education of the labor pool and technical aspects and all these things that would be part of the real economy. The EU scores all of these and then rearranges scorings, and then they want to give other states. So any advantage that you have actually becomes a cost, and it actually becomes an impediment, and you're under constant pressure to privatize these things. Even if they're already privatized, what they mean is actually sell them to foreign countries. And then you have a lot of sabotage, you know, like with hedge funds and stuff, but you have like sabotage on the inside to make sure that these industries are underperforming so that then the argument can be made to sell them to these larger, let's say, banks, Western European conglomerates. And then what do they do with it? They do nothing, right? They just want to pull them out of the competition and then also pull the supply out of the general, you know, whatever, out of the market, right? To, I guess, artificially support price. What that has meant is massive unemployment in Bulgaria and Romania. And, you know, you go to cities like Vienna and every cab driver is Bulgarian, right? And he has a master's degree in chemistry and, you know, and instead he's driving a taxi. He probably doesn't realize that he could probably do better at this point back in Bulgaria. That's what we talk about, soft power. See, he thinks that, you know, if he has to go back to his people from his village or whatever, see him, and he's not a success because he moved back from Austria, from Vienna. But in reality, he would live better, you know, in Bulgaria right now. You know what I'm saying? Like his quality of life, hours worked, the type of woman in his life, all those things combined, the type of food that you eat, what it costs to go to the doctor, things like that. He'd be better off in Bulgaria. And so part of the EU, very interesting, even though these nationalisms were kind of built up in opposition to Warsaw Pact politics, as soon as the Eastern Bloc collapsed, these governments in the Eastern Balkans, we're talking about Bulgaria and Romania, didn't take very long before they forgot all about these national development goals. And pretty soon, like the national or kind of, I don't want to say, you know, yeah, you could say like a national front or the nationalists, but not the way Russians mean the word, not the way that the new left means the word. But the way the old left might mean, you know, like revolutionary nationalists, you know, anti-imperialists. And you get these kind of nationalist things against the EU. And for Bulgaria and Romania, it's difficult because they share a similarity in one. It's more nuanced than something as simple in our minds as, say, Croatia is, because while there were, movements, pro-Hitler type, pro-fascist type movements, Romania, the Iron Guard, you had Anton Ionescu and all this, so people get the idea. And, for example, when you had, you know, a couple months ago when the conflict began, you had like in the European, I think, Parliament, and you had the different, you know, ministers of European Parliament from different countries talking. You had like some Irish green, whatever. She's probably nonsense on every other subject, right? But because every war that NATO does is bad, at least, then, you know, she's against what NATO's doing in Ukraine. So, all right, good on her. And so she's grilling the Bulgarian guy, and the Bulgarian guy, he's actually a member of this neo-Hitler, like pro-Hitler thing, and they love Azov, and they love what Zelensky people are doing in Ukraine. And he gets up and walks out, so it's a lot of drama. These things are still alive. I mean, we're not talking about guys with tattoos in a bar. We're not talking about a fucking skinhead scene or something like this, with like oi and punk. No, this is just regular politics, okay? Regular fascist politics. And people, you know, so you don't always want to overgeneralize, but you can't belabor every detail either. You get the idea. There's always going to be somebody who has something to add to this conversation, but we just can't say everything there is to be said about it because, you know, reality is much more complicated than a conversation about reality could ever be. So moving forward, these types of movements, though, flip and they can be completely, there's history for this too, by the way. So for example, when the Soviets took over Poland, they basically like recreated 1930s Polish ultranationalism, like right-wing ultranationalism as a pro-Soviet state. You see what I'm saying? There was lots of things that were happening in East Germany. They were doing things. In fact, they were trying to bring back, the Soviets were trying to bring back, you know, one or two of the leaders of the brown shirts to be in, and one of them was in Canada, to be in government in East Germany, in pro-Soviet East Germany, right? So some of these things you can flip around, and there's some interesting experiments, and it's counterintuitive. Like if you're ideologically Marxist-Leninist or you're ideologically fascist, it's not going to make sense to you how realists are able to pull these things off, but they do. So the European Union views the Danube region strategy through the lens of four pillars and 12 priority areas. And each of those priority areas kind of matches the typical, you know, it's presented on these very easy to interactives. Everything looks like it's a smartphone, you know, home screen or whatever, with all the different buttons for apps and stuff. And it's like sustainable energy and environmental and water and all the kind of things, as if it was like the UN development goal for 2030 or something like that, except it's the Danube region strategy, you know, prosperity through diversity, whatever. Now, wonderful that they've put all this like theoretical work into doing it, but the thing is that the Russians are light years ahead of them, and they're the ones that are actually going to be able to build the Danube and Balkans region. And why is that? Well, we talked originally about different industries involved and how they plug in. And really, it's not that the Russians have any special sauce. It's just that the EU is so badly organized with this stuff that nearly any other way that you could do it, you'd probably yield, you know, a better result. You see what I'm saying? Even like, you know, 1 or 2% is pretty monumental difference when you're talking about, say, GDP, when it's real GDP difference. And that's instantaneously. The spread, I think, that would emerge would be a far greater gulf. But looking right now at what the Danube, how it's been developed by the EU so far, pretty much it's... You know, there are arguments out there about like when a landlord owns a building but doesn't maintain it, and then people start living in it like squatters and stuff, and then who really controls it. The EU is basically saying, please someone come and manage us better, almost like Ukraine. And so anyhow, this is, as we talked about before, this is not a matter of my opinion. Like I, you know, looked at a map, like I was, you know, smoking reefer, looking at a map and being like, hey man, look at the Danube is so close to Odessa. No, I'm actually talking about white papers printed by General Breedlove, Obama era, you know, right, Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Breedlove's documents written for kind of a advocacy oriented think tank called Jamestown.org, and they do a lot of policy papers, or basically they're, you know, neoliberal neocons. I mean, they're Washington consensus neoconservatives that are trying to basically prop up transatlanticism, and their history neither comes from the real old trajectories of the Committee on the Present Danger or the Trilateral Commission, on the other hand, right? But they're definitely, they're probably, as human beings, came out of Committee on the Present Danger, but they appreciate the discourse of idealism in IR that you see through, like, the human rights pretext for defining, you know, legitimate state activities, or defining the terms upon, you know, bilateral state v. state interactions through the lens of, you know, international human rights or something like that. That's an idealist point of view. We talked about that. So I'm just putting little footnotes for you guys looking at, I don't know, the past episodes, if it was 81 or 82, we got into this. And now, finally, where does this all lead, right? And where does it hook up to? Well, you have, for example, Russia got involved in a huge fight over Syria, right? And it wasn't simply to thwart the division of Syria for abstract, you know, talking about Rimland. Remember we talked about the Rimland? We talked about the different geopolitical theories from 100 years ago. This was Spykman or Speakman work on the Rimland, and we compared that to the ideas of Reich and Mackinder. Okay, and we always like to then draw back to E.H. Carr for those of us who take a little notes and do further reading and stuff. That's there for you. Now, NATO is losing their shit over this because their policies and their posture and the theory of power is and power projection involves a lot of not acknowledging the condition of power deflation. And the real condition of NATO, not just in the Balkans, but anywhere in the world, is on a steady power trajectory decline. So the trajectory of its power is continuing to decline. But it's worse than that, because there are no firm events on the horizon. There's no like precipice that we're approaching that we can say, you know, is the floor in terms of NATO. In other words, it's fair to say that it's all but extinct as an organization. And because despite the things that Russians say about NATO and Ukraine, the big, you know, NATO boogaloo in the neighborhood was Turkey. And being able through not trying to make Turkey a neutral state in terms of some post-Soviet periphery, like the way that Belarus is a quote-unquote Lavrovian neutral state, but that Turkey is not a neutral state, okay, because it's been neutralized, but rather that it is its sovereignty is increasing, and it is augmenting. Its sovereignty of Turkey is growing. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't make alliances with the U.S. or that it won't make alliances with anyone that it wants. In fact, it means the opposite. It means that it can make alliances with whoever it wants, and it can pivot and triangulate from these alliances in a way that only a sovereign state could do. And that is going to be much to the chagrin at times of the Russians and much to the chagrin at times of the Europeans or the Americans. That's what happens when you're a sovereign state. So then when Turkey does things that look like they're amenable to the Russians, you get the media saying, oh, look, there's Erdogan, just another Putin, whatever. And then when they do something else, you get the Russian, you know, loving crowd. Oh, Erdogan, that Turk bastard, Turk, you know, must remove kebab, you know, and they just start to go full mimetic, right? So I think that obviously you see where I feel about that. And it's a more nuanced, you know, role. Turkey has to be defeated in some theaters, you know, and they have to succeed in others. So it's a little weird. And that's just how it goes. that's what it's actually like to analyze these things as coolly as possible. And I think Turkey is a good example of understanding that. And their influence is also growing in the Balkans. I can tell you that they've gotten into their, you know, Turkish banks have gotten big into financing people who want loans to buy gas stations in the Balkans. And so then there's a whole, the whole highway through southern Serbia and through like Bulgaria into towards the European side of Turkey. It's like Turkish flags on the road. That because of the amount of land that the gas stations kind of own, and then maybe there's some local mayors that are being, you know, some palms are being greased, and there's just Turkish flags lining the major highways through the Balkans, through the from the road from, let's say, southern Serbia, like Niš, all the way through to Istanbul. So that tells you something. There's some writing on the wall right there. Turkey has energy, access to energy. They have energy, and they always have a good deal with the Azeris and the Shah Deniz II Energy Consortium around, of course, the Caspian Sea. And always these investment opportunities, by the way, to look at how these connect and with the future of these. And other ones are other ones that have kind of been, go look like they're fading out. Sometimes they come back, and you'll see. Or maybe some of these, there might be some public offering on some of these, or there's many ways to work knowledge of, let's say, the Trans-Adriatic Pipeline project or different things like this. There's different players that come in and out. You were going to have the Persian pipeline that was going to connect the Turks with the Persians. You know, that's pretty historic as well, if you know the history of the Turkish, or the Ottoman, we should say, of the Ottoman courts were not Turkish, they were Persian. Or, you know, kind of like the Khwarizm, or kind of like a Persianized Turks and stuff, and Turkified Persians. Now, broadly, the strategic problem on the Russian side, despite when it happened, they were only beginning to have the awareness of the possibility of it, of using it as an advantage. This would have been around 2008, and you had the Montenegro, you had the NATO successfully pull off a coup of playing, I guess, a coup involving a local, I guess that would have been like the Djukanovic clan and kind of local drug cartel, and they broke off Montenegro from Serbia. That was only, 2008 or so? And happened around the same time as the final Kosovo thing, declaration. And yet, this was the access to the Adriatic, and in the history for Serbia, okay, and this is not a new idea. In the history of strategic thinking in great power rivalry geopolitics of the 19th century, Serbia, Montenegro were always considered like a type of Malorossiya, or like a little Russia, or an extension of Russia on the Adriatic. So this does not mean that the Russian army is going to like militarily confront Romania and Bulgaria in order to gain absolute control over the Danube and then be able to end run the problem of the lack of access to the Adriatic. No, the regular, let's say, energy market geopolitics, and this, from the perspective of sovereign development, the position that, just think about in terms of investors and then look at, try to connect geopolitical moves and connect those things to the concept of investor confidence. For some of you, what I'm saying is like the most obvious fucking shit in the world, and I appreciate your patience with us, but we're talking to everybody now. So just think in terms of how people look at the future, and kind of like when you lick your finger and put it up, you're like, which way is the wind blowing? So people can tell which way the wind is blowing. And the wind is blowing very favorable to Russia. It's a Russian wind. And this is going to blow across the Danube. But the thing is that this doesn't rule out, and what we had been saying about the conflict in Syria is that it wasn't just these things that were abstract, or that it had to do with Spykman's Rimland politics in that sense, although it was. But really, you're talking about the naval base at Tartus. And it's a Russian naval base that Syria has at Tartus, right? So what about the Russian naval base on the Adriatic? Wouldn't that be Montenegro? So you can see why there was a very big push just, what, last year or something. The country has like 200,000 people. You know, maybe on paper 360,000, but about 300,000 of those 360,000 probably live in Serbia, and they just like Montenegro is like a mailing address, and then they vote from Serbia about the direction of Montenegro, and some of them vote intelligently and others vote very stupidly, but the intelligent voters have been defrauded for a long time from, you know, who counts the votes. And those were the Djukanovic clan people in Montenegro, in this little banana republic, narco-traffic microstate, you know, has no historical foundation to be a state at all whatsoever. You know, it's like people talk about, well, here's the problem of the history of the Bosniaks. Muslim Bosnians have a bigger claim to a state than Montenegro. Montenegro is a region, you know, is a region of Serbs. So I don't, you know, whatever. I mean, the women are a little, you know, mannish, but you know, whatever floats your boat. At the same time, you have we've been talking about the strategic crisis from the perspective of NATO, okay? And NATO, they're very clear, okay, that that the outcome, as we were talking about from the Breedlove and others, the outcome of the Ukraine conflict, okay, number one, Russia plus Ukraine equals an empire in the strategic thinking of Henry Kissinger. There's a little chime in my head that says it may have been Brzezinski. But anyway, the thinking is when you have Russia plus Ukraine, that, and you know, this inertia, it's not simply in the static sense, because you can have Russia plus Ukraine, but the events in process are Russia's in the process of losing Ukraine, right? So let's say 1991 or something like that. So Russia plus Ukraine is not a photograph. Yeah, Russia plus Ukraine is a movie, dynamic process. And when it's Russia plus Ukraine, because Russia has the momentum was Russia picks up Ukraine, it's not just Russia picks up Ukraine. It's Russia picks up Ukraine and they pick up the Danube and they pick up strategic dominance in the Central and Western Balkans, not just the Eastern Balkans. And they are then, and they're positioned because of this control of the Black Sea, and then their position vis-a-vis Visegrad states, the Black Sea-Baltic corridor, and they project heavily into the Baltic. That's why you see these stupid statements from countries like, we're thinking about, not allowing Russian boats. Really, with your fucking tugboats and shit? Like, what are these, like, these, these, you have the Baltic states, and then you have the so-called Nordic states, but, I mean, I guess the sea is the Baltic Sea, nevertheless. Yeah, you know, some fucking Pippi Longstocking shit happening over there, but they're definitely going to have a cold winter. And a lot of this stuff is not just, we're not just talking about, like, oh, the military position of, like, the Russian army, and then because the range of their missiles and their tanks is going to put this pressure on the politics. No, no, no. We're talking about the currency. We're talking about the ruble being the strongest growing, most stable currency available in the year 2022. It's the only currency that officially is pegged to a gold floor, and which is the value of that is based upon the real existing value of its actual for sale commodities, right? So they've taken control of their money, and Europe is not in the position to make good on these assets. So it's actually, you can go back to like the kind of the early market philosophy, the early capitalist, you know, thinkers like John Locke, right? And John Locke thinks that it's a moral hazard, really. It creates moral hazard if you have the property and the possibility to invest, and you're actually letting it fallow, right? It's actually, in a sense, a crime, you know, against everyone else. I know it's strange because it's like your property, do what you want with it. But for some reason, and it makes sense if you think it through, I mean, at least John Locke has his argument, and I'm not saying I'm married to it, but it's a very interesting, compelling argument about that having property infers the responsibility to tend to it in a way that interacts with human beings in the most positive way. So I can see how that is, in some cases, not developing it because maybe it's a nature thing. In other cases, it's of important strategic value, maybe militarily or economically. And this is all the above. And so the Georgetown University Berkeley Center, not to be confused with Cal Berkeley in the Bay Area. Okay, so the Georgetown University in the East Coast, Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, they're the ones that do the Berkeley Forum. I know, and then people oftentimes think that the Berkeley Forum is the, you know, in NorCal. It's Georgetown University. Okay, so they have their, whatever, their little policy papers and their essays and stuff. And you can see that their understanding is very clear that when you look at in the 50s, the Soviets had the Pasha Liman naval base in Albania, where you had Soviet attack submarines. And, you know, that was until Hoxha broke with the Soviets in 61. And that was until that. And then he kind of went in the pro-China direction for, that was so interesting. But he had the Pasha Lima naval base, and that's just one example. This is a very different situation today, because even though Yugoslavia, Serbia is much smaller, and they presently don't have that critical piece, Montenegro, which links them up, and they become then a potential power on the Adriatic. Serbia has a power on the Adriatic. From the perspective of a security curtain, one can appreciate the NATO perspective, because there has not been an arms race and an over, like, a clumsy or congested militarization of the Adriatic, you know, that would have been justified by or had as a pretext Montenegro being part of Serbia. This is a thing that, and it surprises many Serbs even themselves, because of Serbia's political strategy, which is that its government plays far more to the Western tune than its actual strategic perspective and positions would seem to lead you to believe. So it's counterintuitive with Serbia. The people of Serbia attack the government for not being sovereign-orient enough, you see. And that allows the government of Serbia to say, we're trying to be as pro-Western as we can. Look, even these opposition parties that make up, wow, they got 5, 10, 20, 30% in the last election, and they're all saying that we're not serving Serbian people enough. So how could we possibly come back to them with this EU-type business proposal for X, Y, and Z? So that's actually how the game works, but it makes the government look not as favorable to the more enthusiastic Serbians as it would otherwise, is how I try to explain it. And then, you know, but the reality is that Yugoslavia as a socialist state was pretty neutral, but its set up and trajectory, especially post whatever it was when the Club of Rome decided to disintegrate, that they were going to do and destroy Yugoslavia as soon as Tito died, and then whatever, 5 or 6 years later, Tito dies, there's no, you know, I guess you would say heir apparent or whatever. I don't know how these dictatorships work, but there's no heir apparent or whatever. And, you know, and that was kind of planned by the West as well. They made sure that enough of their assets were in place that they could agree to not agree. And that agreeing to not agreeing obviously led towards all of the states breaking off from each other, ultimately. And the funny consequence of that, though, is that it has left the Serbian part of that, which is still Belgrade and still the most economically important part of Yugoslavia. You can't say you control the Balkans if you don't control Belgrade. So despite all this stuff all around the Balkans and above and below, like from Hungary down to Greece and from Bosnia over to the Black Sea and Bulgaria, okay, you can't say that you actually control the Balkans if you don't control Belgrade, which is like the, you know, the jewel of the Balkans. It's the largest city in the Balkans if you exclude, of course, Constantinople, Istanbul. But anyhow, so the natural like flow of capital, like water and stuff, without sanctions and without games and without cartels, you would see the prominence of Belgrade a lot further. So breaking down some of these, cartels that are meant to stunt Belgrade, once you have the Danube as a kind of a Russian co-prosperity, you know, waterway, then you're going to have the real full potential of countries like Serbia, like Romania, like Bulgaria finally expressed. And this is so important. This is not just like, market wrap-up Tuesday or something. We're talking about long-term ideological and social differences in the world. We're talking about, one sort of power group that's saying, okay, here's the new deal that we're going to put out. We want people to have more children. We want the economy to be based upon growth and physical assets and property ownership and, you know, you in the driver's seat type of thing. And to the extent that there's government and government policies, we want to engineer these to say, you know, here's another tax tax refund or whatever for your third kid or whatever, your fourth kid, et cetera. So you have a pro-natal policy, and you have many other things. You have like an 18% flat tax, basically. So that's great. It sucks on sales tax and stuff like that because that is there. But that's awful. But so you can see that it can turn out to be about 38-40% at least on that. But then everything that you're selling is that all of that buying and selling is that 18% getting hit on that all the time. But it's uniform and it's easy to understand and it's easy to cost out. So it's not that it's not business prohibitive from an accounting perspective. And the 18% income tax is much preferred to, for example, where I was in California. I was begging, I was hoping not to get a raise at a certain point because that tax bracket, they would have had to really pay about $45,000 a year more just to make it worth it where I was at. So how dumb is that, right? Anyway, so what the Georgetown University is aware that that Russian soft power has been building up these narratives about, through the historical, cultural, and religious connections that tie Russia to the Balkans. So they're aware of that. And then, and they are also aware that the Orthodox Church has been a big part of that. And so then it raises up all of those things again. Those are dog whistles, you know, to, you know, enter Catholic, enter Muslim, and say, oh, remember all these bad things, and what about Sarajevo, and, you know, or with the Catholics, what would it be? The filioque, or is it like, is it the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, or is it, okay. and they say this. Listen to how they frame it, okay? And this is exactly right, by the way, okay? Serbia has been perceived as Russia's kin state in the region, a much smaller version of the Russia-Belarus relationship, which involves manipulating identity politics. Like, that's like saying, which involves building buildings out of material and people breathing air. Like, of course, social engineering projects involve, I mean, you don't manipulating identity politics. You do that shit on accident. That's like, if you just have media, you're going to influence culture. Even if you're trying to just reflect culture, you're going to do it through how you understand it, through your lens. And then through reflecting culture, even if you get it right, you're going to extend the amount of time that culture is in that moment. If media only reflects culture, then you're actually going to artificially stultify or stunt the development of culture. Anyway, it's dumb. Obviously, identity is something which we're not born with. It comes with agreement and it comes with indoctrination. There's no way that you can just look at faces when you break outside of like the main three racial groups or something. Like once you're beyond, you know, whatever Caucasoid, Mongoloid, and Negroid or whatever, and you're like, people could be fucking Lebanese or German Yale or anything, right? It's very hard to tell people if you really know your people. If you really know people, you actually know it's even harder to tell by the face alone or whatever, color alone. You really have to know people. And yet, in the West, they're kind of promoting this idea that that when we notice differences, that this is a product of some defect of our own mind, or that, you know, we've been brainwashed to notice that there's differences, and that children don't notice. No, children are the first ones to notice differences. Just because they're not afraid or don't have value judgments like prejudice that come with those differences, kids are not colorblind. They're like, man, that kid is black. Like, yes, yes, baby, that is a very black child, you know. Wow, I want to go play with them. Go for it. You see? So they don't have the baggage for it, but they notice the differences. Why am I saying this? Because this is actually connected to a broader thing. When they open this critique, when they're opening this analysis, it has many good points, and they're talking about Russia's angle being historical, cultural, and religious, and that gets right into identity politics. It actually gets into the culture war stuff, okay? The next big admission goes like this. Okay, listen. As one of the last regions of Europe that has not yet been fully integrated into Euro-Atlantic structures, the Balkans present an obvious target for Russian influence operations. The reason it hasn't been fully integrated, asshole, is because you are the ones responsible for letting those fields lay fallow. You've got factories rusting out. All right? You've got factories rusting out. That is your integration. The fact that people politically reject your suicidal economic policies doesn't mean that they have not been fully integrated. They've just been fully integrated and fucking hate you. And you're not developing it. You had your go, dude. That was your chance. You don't get another do-over or whatever. And obviously, the only true aspect of not fully integrated is Belgrade. And that's why they mention Serbia as being Russia's kin. Because you can't say you control the Balkans if you don't control Belgrade. And so they say all of this, they agree, okay? that's what's nice about realism, is that you can read the analysis from the totally other people who have totally other vision of what they want to see the outcomes be, and their analysis of where the pieces are and what the stakes are is going to be, you know, generally correct. They throw in their shibboleths they must utter to, so that you're reading this and you realize, oh yeah, yeah, they're the good guys, because you're reading this stuff and like, wow, Russia's in a really strong position. Wow, that sounds really good. Oh, Russia doing good. So they have to throw in the words like Kremlin and Tsarist and Byzantine and shit like that. It's like, oh yes, but it's evil. Yes, they're succeeding, but we're not happy that they're succeeding. Correct. Yes, yes. So you do throw those in, of course, but otherwise you delete that. You actually have a good go at getting some information. And they say, I'll share the link later, by the way. I'll put it in the, I'll figure out how to get it for people for the recording later. I'll put it in the link in the conversation right now. You guys can have a look at it with me. Yeah, there it is. And let me see if I can... Yeah, good enough. All right. Russian overt and covert influence operations in the Balkans have been aimed at fostering local people-to-people connections and creating friendly constituencies and various levels of influence. Russia's second approach was to exacerbate existing political and social fissures within a country, betting that such moves would inhibit further integration into Western economic, political, or security structures. I think that is that in reference to what? To Bosnia or Ukraine? It's not clear what they're referring to there, but they say, but there's also been a tit-for-tat moment. Since NATO has been expanding across former Soviet republics that Moscow considers its spheres of influence, well, I would say that, you know, 170,000 dead Ukrainian soldiers also contributes to our understanding that this is part of Russia's sphere of influence. They have certainly fucking influenced the outcome there. That's what happens when you challenge. If you use words that Moscow considers, instead of just saying this is Moscow's historic sphere of influence, when you use language like considers, yeah, it's true that they consider it that way. But the fact that it is part of their sphere of influence is not because they consider it that way, but because it is. And that's kind of the kind of tricky language that gets used and can lead people to thinking that possibilities exist that don't exist, like possibilities to stop Russia from, that it only considers Ukraine its sphere of influence. Like, no, it doesn't only consider it, it is. And now you're finding out how much it is. So anyway, this goes on. Moscow enjoys a series of local assets, including highly placed Serb nationalist politicians such as Milorad Dodik, a member of Bosnia and Herzegovina's tripartite presidency, and Aleksandar Vučić, Serbia's powerful president. Powerful. Hold on. Oh, bože. One second. Yeah, so we were at how powerful Vučić is. And then there are also biker gangs. friendly paramilitary militias, murky businessmen, pro-Russian media outlets, and above all, the transnational Serbian Orthodox Church. Hey, folks, I know that you've heard about the Jesuits, but wait until you learn about the Serbian Orthodox. They've got agents, you know, working in every organized religion to derail those religions in the direction of Serbian Orthodoxy. It's like a country with 7 million people. Russian President Vladimir Putin recruited the Orthodox Church. I just love the way they... I will not stop anymore, but it's hard not to laugh. I'm sorry. Let me continue in all seriousness. Putin recruited the Orthodox Church from the very onset as a primary soft power instrument. Over the years, it has grown to play an instrumental role in advancing Russian interests, not only in countries perceived by the Kremlin as its near abroad, but to all other states where Orthodox Christians live. Because church and religion have always been an important societal and political factors in the region, because church and religion have always been important in this region. Remember we warned about talking in these terms, for example, in 6 years, when France is a failed state and there are Islamic and French nationalist militias in street battles through a sort of, Aleppo-looking Paris, you can imagine a Mariupol Paris or something like that, as seen in the Children of Men, okay? And then I'm going to be writing, I'm going to tell my grandchildren, countries like France and Germany, there were several world wars. It's a historically, unstable region, Western Europe. Historically, the people, they get gripped by these passions and they get these ideas and they act up, but they're very expressive people. They talk with their hands a lot. What other kind of tropes can we use and kind of turn it around back on them? And if it was only a matter of time between, these Catholics and Lutherans started butchering each other again, only a matter of time. It's just like, it's the region, it's a neighborhood, it's not civilized. It's not, it's Europe after all. You just imagine that, what do you mean? But if you had heard that kind of talk since you were a kid, then and you'd seen, and every movie had shown Europe through some yellow lens or something, you would think it was that, and it will be that probably, if actually things don't chill out. So they go on. The Russian Orthodox Church's main interlocutor in the region is the Serbian Orthodox Church, which concomitantly has a close relationship with the Serbian state and often provides religious legitimacy to domestic and foreign state policies. Okay, kind of like how Satanist Hollywood is just a branch of the Democrat junta in control of Washington, right? It's the same thing, right? So we understand that point of reference. Outside of Serbia, the Serbian Orthodox Church controls parishes in Bosnia's autonomous Republika Srpska entity. It is an entity. You could also call it an autonomous republic by the name Republika Srpska, Montenegro, Croatia, and parts of Kosovo. Hence, Moscow's political and religious influence trickles down and cascades through Belgrade. So strong has this influence been that while much of the world stood in solidarity with Ukrainians in March 2022, thousands and thousands of citizens in Serbia and in the autonomous Republic of Srpska organized mass rallies in support of Russia and President Vladimir Putin. Among those marching were Serb members of the notorious Kremlin-backed bikers club, the Night Wolves, members of pro-Kremlin NGO Sveti Georgije, and also members of the ultra, I think they just found one tiny little group that signed on to the march or whatever, that NGO, never mind, and also members of the ultra-nationalist Ravnagora Chetnik movement. Russian-friendly media outlets in the region eagerly reported on the rallies and lionized the Russian military. Finally, there are Russian oligarchs with ties to the Russian Orthodox Church and the Kremlin who can provide Moscow with a useful mask of deniability should things go wrong. The most prominent example is Konstantin Malofiev, who is strongly linked with Milorad Dodik, the Bosnian Serb member of the presidency strongly linked. Remember that expression. It's an important one because it means nothing. Looking at Russia's interest in the Balkans from a broader perspective, it is interesting to note that in the 1990s, Russia was too weak to carve its sphere of influence in the former Yugoslavia despite its greatest efforts. It was NATO, led by the United States, that dominated for many years. However, as the United States diverted its attention and resources to Afghanistan and Iraq in the 2000s, development, security, and state building of the Western Balkans was outsourced to the European Union. The lack of a coherent EU strategy, no, it's quite coherent. The strategy is under development. That's when you understand. That's when you understand. The lack of a coherent EU strategy towards the region produced no viable steps forward, true enough, and eventually the Kremlin saw an opportunity to step in. I would call it a moral imperative. Moscow had been sending trial balloons to see what it could get away with before hitting hard when an opportunity appeared, and the lack of any meaningful Western response was interpreted as a sign of weakness. Yes, that is how to interpret a lack of a response. And they have correctly assessed that the opportunity arose, and they did hit hard when it did appear. And the lack of any Western response, this is me speaking, is not the product of an abstract thing like resolve or discipline. It's actually the product of their literal weakness. They actually can't do it. They don't have the numbers. They don't have the economy. They don't have the military to do these things. If you thought that they did, that's a product of their marketing. Now you're seeing, what do the Chinese used to call it? Paper tiger. Paper tiger. Over the years, this is the article, numerous religious, business, and political networks have been knitted, including within the criminal milieu. Yes, of course, because Montenegro for NATO was not led by Djukanovic, right? The criminal milieu between Moscow and the Balkans. The consequences of this partnership are likely to have serious implications sooner rather than later. We already see the results of Moscow's co-option and subversion efforts, which have managed to not only stall, but reverse democratic and political gains achieved by Western involvement since the 1990s. Oh, by the way, the guy writing the article, you have an extra assignment if you want to find out who Harun Karacic is, if it's, you know, at all, you know, his he's a Muslim scholar who does this dance. They're learning from another group I won't mention, but they're pretending to be against everyone else's nationalism and irredentism and the right wing, and they talk about it. You would think that they were the victims. You would think that Islamic discourse in the Balkans was like identical to the migrant experience in Western Europe in the 1980s or something. You see what they're trying to do? They want to make you think that these people are minorities when actually they're the dominant hegemonic paradigm in the state that they dominate and control. They're not the minorities and they're not the victims. They are the power group where they are. And they're mostly Muslim Brotherhood, okay? And that those are the real existing links, the tunnels, whatever, the networks that feed people in to get into, be connected to these transatlantic organizations, okay? His bio blurb says that he's authored numerous articles on geopolitics and religion, particularly Islam, in the post-communist Balkans. He also writes about the role played by foreign powers, including Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey. His scope has now more recently expanded to include China and Russia, cha-ching, as well. He also regularly reports on Muslim minorities in Europe and rising right-wing nationalism. Yeah, right. You call that you're supposed to see right-wing nationalism as the problem from the perspective of Muslim minorities in Europe, but where Muslims are the majority in a you know region that's historically Muslim, like in the West Balkans, there is that, and you can be fair and say that. Because that's 500 years is a sufficient amount of time. You'd have to erase everything from after Christopher Columbus, let's say, in the New World, if you want to go back to what's legitimate. So, fair enough. It's indigenous Balkan Muslims at this point in time, we can say. And that's all good. The thing is that these people are to Islam, just to understand. These people are to Islam like what the Vatican is to Christianity, just to understand. So the Muslim Brotherhood stuff has always been attached to the intrigues of the British Empire abroad, like Lawrence of Arabia and all this stuff, the anti-Ottoman conflicts in the Middle East and that stuff. If you read a dumb Wikipedia article about the Muslim Brotherhood, they're going to say that they're like a anti-colonial resistance movement and they've been fighting against the British. Well, I guess there are moments when one bites the hand that feeds, but in generally speaking, it's still the hand that feeds. His concern with these are code words. Right-wing nationalism, when they're worried about it, only means this Russian thing, right? That's why when you look at Ukraine, they have such a narrative vacuum because who is Russia fighting against? You see what I'm saying? But they actually, if anyone, even if you're sympathetic to this guy's, to Harun Karcic's politics, this is the author of the piece that we've been having a laugh with. His own views would be considered theocratic, right-wing, and ultranationalist. But he's just learned the recipe, the gimmick, like as if he was a waiter and learned that at this restaurant how you're supposed to speak to the guests and stuff. That's all. Okay, so he's working at a new restaurant now. And, you know, to say something is bad, right? See, where he grew up, they were talking about things in terms of, is it ficht? Is it, haram? You know, is it, right? But now he translated into, is it undemocratic? When these guys have been seizing power undemocratically in every election in Bosnia for the past, 25 years, right? So that's the reality of it. Just to look at, because you want to kind of sometimes see who these fucking nut jobs are. But he goes on anyway, and you can, but in when you peel behind, yes, baby, just a little bit. I'm almost done. Yes, little baby. I did. Doji. Doji. Idemo. Come on. Uh-huh. Dada. Uh-huh. Tamo. Okay.
We
are understanding that the actual points that he's making that are substantive in nature are correct and they do accurately reflect the situation, and we're showing how and why NATO and the cabal is shitting its pants, collectively speaking, over the situation in Ukraine. Because it's not, a lot of our attention in the mainstream news has, here, take this, die, has focused on Latvia and Lithuania. And it's true that this is part of the consequences of the outcome of the Ukrainian conflict. Ayde. Polako, chicken. Uh-huh. Prietno. Sorry. They are accurately reflecting the situation despite all of the funny language that we get to like unwrap from it. So that's kind of the fun part. But the informative part is understanding that they're aware of the outcomes. And despite the media focus on the Baltic, the Balkans economically, geopolitically, is a much larger region. It's much more central to events. It's in between these big powers. It's not really kind of tucked up the way, you know, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia right now exist because of diplomacy, right? I mean, they exist as a product of diplomacy. They don't exist because there's some powerful Lithuanian fucking army that resisted the Soviet Union or something like that. No, this is a political outcome and a diplomatic outcome. And those things never last forever, right? I mean, right? Because then eventually you get like a test, like a trial about what's what, like what's real. It's kind of like it's time to call bluffs. Everyone show your cards. You see what I'm saying? And that's kind of like what's going on right now. The other countries started to call NATO bluffs, starting with the red line in Syria. I'm telling you that year, 2012, 2013, was a massive paradigm shift in terms of what NATO is or what the West is, militarily speaking. It's not like with Iraq and Afghanistan, where the minimal use of force and the prolonged periods of occupation was cover for military-industrial complex, you know, racketeering and money laundering scheme, typical everyday business. Obviously, that was not a real sign of weakness. That was okay. That's different from Syria. That's a very different type of outcome than the outcome that you get in Syria. This was all in and being defeated. And just to understand where that really was in reality, the U.S. did not hold back. They were held back. You had John Kerry begging Lavrov to meet and convene deconfliction talks and then make a public statement, have a joint press conference together about that. In other words, that's how the U.S. surrenders. They call it a deconfliction talk. And then they declare victory that they've avoided escalation. That's how they surrender. And the U.S. surrendered Syria around then, 2015. So now in this piece, they're noting the history was that Russia was too weak to involve. Now they're strong, and they've had these trial balloons seeing what they can get away with, whatever that means. I don't know what that exactly means. I mean, maybe one of those trial balloons is the Russian Emergency Response Center in Serbia. That's the foundation for any future Russian military base. We've now heard from the Russian side that a military construction base, a full scale, like full, you know, fully labeled, or we can say correct advertising or correct labeling, full scale Russian military base in Serbia can proceed. It may proceed. I translated it that way. I believe that's what's correct. I know that they probably will, but I think the language was it can go forward. And now, the demographics he explains about what people feel and say is also correct. So he says, according to the latest International Republican Institute survey, Bosniak Muslims and Kosovar Albanians are the most ardent supporters of NATO. Yeah, dude. Like, you know, it's like my daughter is like the most ardent supporter of my wife's titty. You know what I'm saying? It's like even bigger than me. Okay. So obviously, Bosniak Muslims and Kosovar Albanians are the most ardent supporters of NATO, right? And the EU and the Western Balkans, he goes on. The war in Ukraine, he says, has provided a rare window of opportunity for the United States to recalibrate its foreign policy and make a forceful comeback to Europe, particularly to the Balkans. Dude, bro, you can take fecal matter and recalibrate it, and you will still have fecal matter, albeit in a different shape, but it doesn't push you forward in your strategic objective. So the reason, and this is where idealism bangs its head against reality time and time again, using words like recalibrate doesn't make it be like, oh yeah, it's you're right, easier said, as they say. So the issue is not the shape that the crap is in, it's the substance of the feces itself that determines its shittiness, right? So he concludes, it is an opportunity that must not be wasted, because any conflict in the Western Balkans has the potential to inflame neighboring NATO member states and hence destabilize the transatlantic military alliance and Western liberal order. Period. End. So that's what he wrote. So you can see what that's all about. And this is not a sky is falling, you know, close the missile gap thing that makes the Russian position look stronger in order to sell more missiles or something like that. These are realistic perspectives of outcomes that aren't in some distant future, but based upon a war that's happening right now, and whose outcomes and the changes in the geography and the map have already occurred. And the changes in great power rivalry and local regional hegemonic power lineups and who sides with who is right now in a process of very big changes. And that comes directly with Russian control of Odessa. Then that leads to Russian domination on the Danube, which makes an end run around the problem of supplying Serbia, because Russia has all but, and I would say they have, made military commitments to defend Serbia explicitly vis-a-vis Sarajevo. People might have thought it was about Kosovo. That's not the thing. Kosovo is always going to activate these KLA cells, and the Russian special forces and similar have already fought them and defeated them recently, and will again. That's the type of stuff that happens there. I think it contains in that direction the more unstable scenario where the stakes are greater, because, in terms of demographics, Serbia doesn't have Kosovo. Legally, they have a claim on Kosovo, but population are not Serbs. Well, they are Serbs by passport, and that is another layer of the dilemma. In fact, the Kosovar Albanian descendant people are Serbian citizens to this day, and Serbia has not done the mistake that Ukraine did with the Donbass and deny them basic stuff. So if everything that they want, they could have, even though their cousin is a member of some terrorist group that's trying to whatever blow things up in Belgrade or something. That's actually the reality. So you have I'm totally supportive of what Albanians naturally want to do and you know, where people need to move. That's all good. Those are individual human beings making decisions that make sense for themselves, whether kids are going to go to school, things like that. Yes, Serbia is a better country to live in than Albania. And because Kosovo, people in Kosovo could probably move to Albania or indefinitely can move anywhere in Serbia because they have Serbian passports. So guess what? They move to other parts of Serbia that haven't been ruined by EU misleadership in Pristina. You see? So it's a very complex thing. It's fairly simple to conclude, though, that the arguments that everyone could agree on, and also where the population is at and where the indigenous support is going to come from, that all points to Republika Srpska, right? That all points to Banja Luka as the capital of a Serbian state, and then it would join with Belgrade. That's really the thing that's going to cause the Russian military to involve directly there. So ideally, then, in our concluding thoughts would be this, and thank you for joining us today. The Russian position in the West Balkans has to be a red line, but much room, but many other barrier positions that they can give up, barrier positions that they could give up in negotiations that can delay time, and to preserve the status quo until the Danube River strategic zone is established. So maybe within 9 months to a year, you would need to delay a war situation in, you know, here where I am, so that you're able to, you know, resupply via air and things like that. Look, you're already going to have these pushes, and it's already happening in Bulgaria and Romania, different kind of pushes and stuff. So the political terrain is malleable enough. And people, see, the thing is that the power of grifters and opportunists is what kind of saves the day in the end. I know this sounds weird, but it's not that, like, there's all these people that want Bulgaria to be, like, a pro-Russian country or something like that in Bulgaria, right? It's just a lot of people in politics and business just kind of go, just like how you chase customers or you chase votes or you chase whatever. So these are just people kind of see which way things are going. So now the same types of people who were getting behind the European train, like, a decade ago are going to get on board the Russian train today. And that's the reality of it. But that's how powerful it is, and that's how you know it's real, right? When it's, and it's going to suck for a lot of people in Romania, Bulgaria, who've kind of been into the Russian story for longer than others, when Russia invariably is going to side, you know, kind of more, what's the word, you know, kind of middle of the road, run of the mill, kind of average politicians that are important because of their contacts and because they've kind of switched sides or something like that. That's going to kind of tend to be what Russia will do with it. If you look at their support for Vučić, which is very strong, right? But those movements and where those are going, like, look at the key industries and do your research, market research on Bulgaria and Romania, and then look at the things that are, especially the things that are fallow and the things that are underdeveloped, that with energy at, you know, the price that that Russia pays for its own energy is just ridiculously cheap, right? It's a cost. You have to figure it in, but, you know, it's just ridiculously cheap. You're, probably cost to them is, you know, few pennies per liter. And that all that pennies per liter of development, right, how many joules is it, calories or whatever, right? That's how you calculate this stuff scientifically, as I understand. And, you know, you don't have that. Europe just doesn't have that. So I always appreciate looking at, you know, Atlanticist sources, NATO sources, and all this stuff, deconstructing kind of the funny language games, but actually the fear and the panic is palpable. It's real. You can see all of the things that they list as Russia's strengths and NATO's weaknesses are accurate, And all they can say is, now is the time to show our resolve. Okay. Well, this was written, you know, in July. And here we are 20 days later in the middle of August. This is a conflict that began, what, February 24th in the stage that we consider it now. And we're still waiting for this resolve, okay? Because it's not a matter of resolve. Eh? Anyway, so there's always more to say about the Danube strategic zone. You can see on the map, it's like huge river. Through the Balkans, that's going to be a huge source to the Black Sea. And it allows Russia to move things, you know, through the whole Balkans and very, very cheaply and efficiently, military, economic. It's a lot of, it's, everyone agrees. Everyone agrees. So these are the reasons that I not only think that Odessa has to be in the conclusion scenario of the Russian operation, that they would be kind of, it'd almost be a neglect if they didn't. You see, it would be neglect if they didn't. And I would even say that they have suffered some defeat, whether they admit it or not, if they don't end up with Odessa at this point. So it's like that. And but everyone seems to think on both sides that they're going to end up succeeding with their aims. And Shoigu said it again today. He's always very cryptic about, you know, what that actually means. It's like, so when you say neutral, what does that mean? You know, like when you say denazification, like what does that really mean? You know, and it's kind of vague. And then what you're really seeing is, what is our policy? Our policy is knowing that international law says that we have to negotiate with the head of that sovereign state, which is Zelensky. But the reality that the U.S. cabal cannot admit is that Zelensky is a cabal-controlled whatever crisis actor. Okay, and they can't say those magical things that would make the discussion be between Russia and United States. Well, number one, therefore, Russia has not attacked Ukraine's sovereignty if they have to negotiate with the United States. So that could have exposed kind of in the rhetorical sense, but why not just make good on this situation and like follow through with the logical outcome of their own claims, which is that Zelensky is the guy to talk to. Very well, let's talk to Zelensky. Oh, nothing. Oh, well, then let's just keep taking fucking land. You see? So that's how it works. Anyway, it's been real. All right. I had this one and the other one the other day to get on the drive. I'll do it now. All right. Peace.